The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. I am back after going long yesterday doing a fascinating podcast with Jane Costin of the New York Times. She is a young and rising media star, and so she sat down with me for nearly an hour. You can go to the interview with Hugh Hewitt on iTunes, Spotify, the Salem Podcast Network, and listen to it. I'll play an excerpt from it. I think it's the definitive explanation that elite media, legacy media, and we define it in our conversation as left, 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 and an extension of the Democratic Party. And I'll play a clip in the third segment this hour, but I want you to listen to the whole thing. She's sharp and smart and fair-minded and willing to answer direct questions. Most of my media guests often hem and haw and avoid questions. She doesn't. She's willing to respond to serious, well-framed inquiries. And at the end of any kind of conversation that's based like that, you walk away saying, well, the media is overwhelmingly biased to the left. Elite media is, and that changes the American political spectrum. And better that you hear it from a New York Times journalist than from me. I've been saying it for 31 years on the air. She is not, I don't know, she might be 31, but she obviously gets it. And so I recommend you listen to it at the interview with Hugh Hewitt and send it to all your friends who say the media is fine, fair, and boy, the only thing is they engage in too much both sides-isms and they're actually corporatist, et cetera. Just send them the Jane Costin interview from the interview with Hugh Hewitt. Overnight in Israel, they thought maybe Hamas had had enough. From 1 a.m. in Israel to 9 a.m. in Israel, no rockets were fired by the terrorist organization Hamas against the civilians of Israel. And then all hell broke loose at 10 o'clock in Israel about 3 hours ago, at the time I'm talking to you, in Israel during the day. Waves, multiple waves of missiles on Israeli communities near the Gaza border, and an anti-tank missile fired by a Hamas operative and a military bus. Once again, not the world's brightest terrorist. He hit an empty bus, thank God. But he didn't think it was empty, and it did hit the bus, and it destroyed the bus. Israel has been worried that Hamas is looking for some kind of spectacular attack by sea. They have naval commandos, or via tunnel right up to the border, or something with which they can declare victory and go home, because they're getting pounded. And Israel pounded them overnight, and they will now pound them again overnight, because Hamas does not get the message. Stop firing rockets at Israeli citizens. So the Wall Street Journal reports there is mounting pressure among the U.S., Egypt, Qatar, several European nations for a ceasefire. I note that the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, Morocco are not mounting pressure for a ceasefire because they view Hamas as what it is, an extension of Iran. And Team Biden is not bad. They could be a little bit, they've got to do what they've got to do. More that way, but they're not bad. It is driving the progs. And look, the Democrats are divided on Israel, deeply divided on Israel. And I think the majority are with Representative Jayapal, who was on CNN with Jake Tapper yesterday, cut number four.
Well, I don't agree with that assessment. I mean, I don't think that there's been a situation in the world where you've had intense violence where it hasn't been helpful to have a full diplomatic, full court press from the United States and the UN. So to have the UN come out with a ceasefire resolution is very important. I don't think it's appropriate that the United States blocked that. And in fact, I think that might have, emboldened Netanyahu even more. more. So we have to use that tool. I think that President Biden has been giving a very mixed message. As you say, it's transitioned, and I'm happy that that has happened, but we're a little bit too late to the picture with that. And I think Benjamin Netanyahu thinks that Joe Biden is going to stand by him, and I think we have to quickly reverse that idea. I think sending out this arms sale in the middle of it, approving the arms sale in the middle of it, sends an extraordinarily bad message.
Well, let's talk about that.
We have a number of tools that we can use.
Actually, it sends exactly the right message, which is the message that America stands with Israel, as the overwhelming majority of Americans do, not the radical left that controls the Democratic Party and the media, but Americans do. She continued on, Representative Jayapal did with Jake Tapper, cut number 5.
Well, we condemn Hamas's firing of those rockets, but I think you have to look at what prompted even that behavior. I think there was, the continuing annexation that Israel has been undertaking for years, actually. And, you know, Jake, I was at Khan al-Ahmar several years ago when the bulldozers arrived to bulldoze that village. It was stopped by an injunction from the Supreme Court. But this has been a pattern of action from Israel that, frankly, has taken away the idea even of a two-state solution, has led to increased hopelessness from the Palestinian people. And I think what Hamas has done is, obviously, we condemn that, but we have to look at the power balance here, or imbalance, as it were, and we have to put more responsibility on Israel in maintaining peace in the region. And so I think a lot of this, when you look at the bombing of the AP building, when you look at the indiscriminate bombing that has been happening, the disproportionate loss of lives of Palestinians, you just have to be in a situation where you cannot, we have to do everything we can as the United States to...
That's enough. It's so full of lies. Normally, that's my whole quotient for the show of allowing democratic lies. Israel did not start this. Hamas did. It's not the AP building. It was the Hamas building in which they were using AP as a shield. It is not indiscriminate. It just goes on and on. That's the left. Israel will defend itself. They ought to. Team Biden declined to impose sanctions on the Nord Stream pipeline. This is an enormous defeat for freedom, an enormous caving to Germany and Russia. So now Joe Biden has done more for Russia in 4 months than Donald Trump did in 4 years. Donald Trump sanctioned the heck out of Russia and was accused of Russia collusion. Donald Trump hands him the Nord Stream. You got to wonder. The House backed the January 6th commission. The Senate doesn't look like it will. Texas Governor Abbott signed a fetal heartbeat abortion ban. Now, that won't come to the Supreme Court at the same time as the Mississippi law will. But if that Mississippi law is upheld, the fetal heartbeat law will be upheld. Markets had a terrible day yesterday. The Federal Review hinted that maybe they're not going to stay forever at low interest rates. Meanwhile, what a day for Bitcoin. It fell by as much as 30%. I told you, don't invest in what you don't know and what you can't afford to lose on something that's made up and is a fiction. Meanwhile, Peter Thiel and J.D. Vance, who are two smart guys, invest in Rumble. They've invested in Rumble. Now, I'm already on Rumble, and with Thiel and Vance behind it, that means an incredible surge of capital and conviction. By the way, the reason Bitcoin's got an insoluble problem, it's a dirty currency, according to Financial Times, because it uses so much power to create its coins. And its coins, which are backed by blockchain technology, are nevertheless ridiculously dirty. They use a lot of CO2. Finally, Russell Moore, who has for years been a fine and terrific and widely admired leader of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, has left to join Christianity Today. Good luck to Dr. Moore. He's an inspirational, learned scholar and leader. He is, however, not spelling doom at the Southern Baptist Convention. The Washington Post headline writers today have Russell Moore's departure from the Southern Baptist Convention's leadership prompts question over its future. No, not really. The Southern Baptists are really not dependent on one person. It's not a political organization, not a political movement, not a city council. It's not a corporation being led by Steve Jobs. It's the Southern Baptist Convention, which has been around for a very long time and is going to be around for a very long time and isn't about one leader. And one leader going to Christianity Today. I think that's about the silliest headline. Sometimes the headline writers want clicks and not to convey it. But good luck to Dr. Moore, and the Southern Baptist Convention will continue to prosper. Market reports and the interview with Shane Costin, an excerpt of that, during the break, and go download it at the interview with Hugh Hewitt at iTunes, Spotify, Salem Podcast Network, everywhere, and come right back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined by Eliana Johnson of the Washington Free Beacon, where she is the editor-in-chief. Good morning, Eliana. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm great. How are you?
Great. I want to begin with, over at the Washington Free Beacon, there is a story headlined, Obama Bros Urge Donation to Terror-Linked Charity, by Adam Credo. Several countries have banned the Islamic Relief Charity for allegedly funneling money to Hamas. Let's be fair to the three young men who are never fair to anybody. They originally backed Islamic Relief online, and then they took it down. So they are either ignorant or they got caught. What do you think?
It's hard to say, you know, can't put yourself in their heads, but it is true. They posted a tweet expressing sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians and urging their followers to donate to a number of charities, including Islamic Relief. The State Department has cut ties with Islamic Relief's umbrella organization, Islamic Relief Worldwide, because they believe it takes the funds that are donated charitably and funnels them to Hamas, and Israel considers it a terror-linked charity, and the tweet has now come down. Hard to say what happened because they did not respond to a request for comment about why it was included in this tweet. But, you know, the Obama bros were at the center of the Israel coverage. They've been at it for about a week when Tommy Vitor said he knew that the AP did, in fact, work out of the same office building as Hamas. He had spoken to people in the building, and therefore, I think, lent credence and justification to Israel's decision to bomb that building and took a lot of blowback from their followers. So it seems to me that in the wake of that, they've been going out of their way to demonstrate that they stand with the Palestinians on this.
It's so transparent. It's exactly what happened, Eliana. They are so transparent. John Favreau, John Lovett, Tommy Vitor. Now, I think Lovett's smarter than the other two. Tommy's kind of a clown, and John is sort of Ben Rhodes' alter ego. And they're the privileged pod boys, and it's hard to treat them with other than bemused contempt because they don't know much, and they speak a lot, and they may be, I guess Favreau could write a speech that was like a C-level White House speechwriter speech on some occasions. But they are making bank off of having an audience to which they serve exactly what the audience wants to hear. And they departed from it briefly with Vitor's comments that, yeah, AP shouldn't have been in that. You know, I'm interpreting here. AP knew what was coming and he had to retreat. So they tried to, oh, look, we're really pro-Palestinian and pro-Hamas without saying it. And then they stuck their foot in it and now they're screwed. But it won't matter because on the left, everything is forgiven, right?
I think that's right. And I mean, the original Vitor tweet that he was being critical of Israel in the tweet, but it does tell you kind of where the left is. You can't even he took a lot of blowback for even saying, yeah, I spoke to people in the building. I was in the building. He still believed Israel shouldn't have done what it did.
Yeah, but nevertheless, he confirmed the fact that if you reward something like using journalists as shields or children as shields, then it will get repeated. And AP ought to have known better. Interesting this morning, Iranian President Rouhani is quoted in the Israel National News as saying, we have reached agreements with the superpowers on the main part of the agreement. The West has agreed to remove key sanctions on oil, petrochemicals, shipping, insurance, and central banks. What do you make of that? If that report is correct from IsraelNationalNews.com, what do you make of it?
I make of it bottom news of the day. You know, it seemed to me that from the time Biden won the election, when he was inaugurated, it was very clear where this was headed, and that Biden officials, Rob Malley, Tony Blinken, and the president himself are just trying to chart a path back into the Iran deal that humiliates the U.S. the least. But they are willing to accept a fair amount of humiliation.
Are you at all surprised by the depth and breadth of the anti-Israel media coverage of this war?
I am. It's amazing, Hugh. I am deeply interested in what's happening. I want to know what's happening. And I find that it's really hard if you read the American press to find out what actually is happening on the ground, because instead you get tendentious takes in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and elsewhere. You really have to read the Israeli press to find out what is happening on the ground over there.
I agree. There are three. The Times of Israel, J-Post, that's the JerusalemPost.com, and YNetNews.com. Those are English language. You don't have to speak any Hebrew. And they have a lot of news. They're not, interestingly enough, they're not covering the political situation out of deference to those who are in harm's way, but which is a fascinating story as well. But they cover the war. And I don't think most Americans, unless they're listening to the show, will realize that Hamas stopped rocketing from 1 to 9 a.m. last night and then began barraging Israel again with hundreds more missiles this morning. And so I don't see a ceasefire tomorrow. Do you?
I don't think so. I think we saw over the past 24 hours that Bibi is not going to heed what President Biden's instructions to cease fire. That doesn't surprise me, but it was an early test, I think, of Biden's sway with Bibi. I don't see a ceasefire coming. A couple other things. If you read the American press, it would be very hard to tell that this started with Hamas firing a barrage of rockets into Israel. The focus has really been on the effects of Israel's retaliation on the Palestinians. And, it struck me the AP, after that building was demolished, their bureau chief wrote a diary about his experience of running out of the building and watching it crumble. And you know, the word Hamas was not in that piece.
It's remarkable. It's actually kind of remarkable. Do you know who Jane Costin is?
I do.
Okay, and I admire her work. She is a young journalist. I admire her work. She was on my podcast yesterday at length, and she agreed to do exercise with me where I asked for her intuition about what percent of the elite media, and we defined it as the 5,000 or so people who work for the bigs, the Post, the Times, the networks, et cetera. And I ran through a bunch of hypotheticals. What percentage of elite media favored confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett? She said 5%. I asked her, what percentage favored, voted for Donald Trump? She said 2%. Then I asked her, okay, what percentage are solidly pro-Israel? I mean, solidly pro-Israel, like Hugh Hewitt pro-Israel in the current war. And she said 12%. Do you agree with that number?
That seems... you know, hard to tell, but I don't think it's crazy. I do think I'd be interested in who she thinks supported the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, but didn't vote for Trump.
Yeah, that's
between that 2 and 5%.
That probably some legal reporter who knows that Amy Coney Barrett is brilliant. So I hope you listen to it. It's fascinating. Maybe the next generation of media elites will be honest, Eliana. And that's what I love about Jane. She just answered the questions. Most when I get elite media reporters, they hem-haw, want to argue about definitions when everyone knows what we're talking about. And she's willing to tell me what she thinks. And when you add up all of her answers, left media is way left wing. And it is an extension of the Democratic Party. And boy, have we seen it on the Israel defense of itself against the Hamas terrorist attacks.
Yeah. Well, first on Jane, Hugh, I think what distinguishes her is that she is interested in conservatives and conservatism. I'm a fan of her podcast. I think that the debates she hosts and moderates are excellent. And she doesn't treat them with contempt, which sets her, with sneering disdain and contempt, which distinguishes her from more or less the rest of the mainstream media. But I also think on the politics of the mainstream, you know, it is an extension of the party. And I often think, you know, I run a newspaper with, we're open about our conservative bent. I know these people when I see them. I know I can see people's political biases. And the Times and the Post, you know, they are the left-wing free beacon. I know my adversaries.
They are very left-wing free beacon. And that doesn't mean that they don't have me as a columnist or Mark Thiessen as a columnist or Henry. They do. We're kind of missionaries. And you might have a liberal columnist there. But, Eliane, I want to go back to Israel. I think they have now discovered they're destroying the missile launchers very effectively with new technology, and they're not going to stop because they can't get resupplied because of the Abraham Accords, which is a major triumph for Donald Trump. Do you expect Israel to stop before they think they've done as much damage to those launchers and that missile supply as possible?
A couple of things. No, I don't expect them to stop. But, you know, I would like it if the Biden administration would say that it is in the American national interest to see Hamas defeated and humiliated, because they have a detrimental effect in Gaza. And we, you know, it hurts any chances of moderates rising to Palestinian leadership. So that would be nice to hear. Yes, it is about Israel. It's in their interest to defeat Hamas, but it's also in our interest to utterly humiliate them.
100%. Eliana Y. Johnson on Twitter and thefreebeacon.com online. Stay tuned, America. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I was with a bunch of Republican senators this past weekend, and they all said if we don't hang on to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania seat being vacated by the retiring Pat Toomey, it's going to be very tough to get to 51. So who will that candidate be? Sean Parnell wants it to be him. Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Hey, Hugh. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back. You know, Kurt Schlichter was the first guy to text me when you declared for the Senate seat in Pennsylvania. He said, I hope you have Sean on. I said, of course I'll have Sean on. I think you might live with Kurt when he guest hosts for me. You might get a cot in the studio. But, Sean, first, for the benefit of the Steelers fans who are a little bit slow and may have forgotten, would you go back over who you are and where you're from?
So, yeah, I'm from Western Pennsylvania. I was born in Oakland, which is right outside the city of Pittsburgh. Went to Greensboro Central Catholic High School. Went to Clarion University, was an elementary education major. I remember waking up with a little hangover, turning on the TV set just in time to watch an airplane crash into the World Trade Center. A few days after that, I went down to the recruiter, told that guy I wanted to join the infantry. Not just the infantry, I wanted to go to airborne school where they teach you how to jump out of perfectly good airplanes. And then I wanted to go to Ranger school, and then on the front lines of the war in Afghanistan, you know. And that this is sort of when I learned the life lesson of be careful what you wish for, because a few years later, I was in Afghanistan getting shot at every day with the mission of finding Osama bin Laden. Unfortunately, we didn't find him, but we found a lot of bad guys there over 485 days of combat. And I ended up being wounded, came back, went to Duquesne, got my master's degree, and President Trump called me out about 10 years later. To run for Congress. And I didn't meet, I've never met him, never spoke to him. And he came to Western Pennsylvania, spoke at the Marcellus Shale Coalition, called me out to run. And I turned my life upside down and got in the race in 2020. And man, it was an incredible experience for sure. But here we are again.
Now, I am curious, Sean, you will win a congressional seat if you run in a redistricted congressional seat. Connor Lamb is going off to run for Senate. You might get a rematch with Connor Lamb. You lost by this much to Connor Lamb. Why not take the safe route? I mean, that's the obvious question. Connor Lamb leaves. It's your district. It'll be redrawn, but it'll be your district. You'd win in a walk, especially in an off year against an empty incumbent. Connor Lamb being a Marine himself, that was a sort of combat veteran versus combat veteran. Why go for Senate?
Well, I think, you know, the Senate is where the critical fight is. And one of the things that they teach you is, as a young leader in the military, leadership is all about going to where the fight is the toughest. And as you mentioned leading in, Hugh, Senate control depends on the state of Pennsylvania. We have to hold this seat, and we have to give our best. We have to give ourselves our best opportunity to win, you know, even with no political experience. Right. I got in the race for Congress. It was not part of my life's plan at all. Right. Like one of my life's ambition was not to be a politician. But we got in the race with no political experience. We amassed over 10 months time, 45,000 individual donors, thousands. And I mean, thousands of volunteers that believed they were part of something greater than themselves. We called ourselves Parnell's Platoon, which I know sounds kind of silly, but people liked it and it was fun. And I think another consideration, Hugh, is that when you look at the census data here in Pennsylvania, the vast majority of the population decrease was here in Allegheny County in Western Pennsylvania with a 9.2% decrease in population. So, you know, in all likelihood, and I don't know what the districts look like, but I think there's a real good chance that PA 17 goes away because it's a geographically small district, either gets merged with the city of Pittsburgh and Congressman Doyle's district, or merged with PA 16 and Mike Kelly's district, in which case there's no political path for me. But there is an open Senate seat here, and being default aggressive and audacious has always been part of the way that I do business. And so that's where we're going.
Sean, where is the campaign website for Senate?
Yes, it's parnellforsenate.com. You can find out all about my platform. You can go and contribute to the campaign and join the movement. But don't do that on Google, because if you try to Google Sean Parnell for Senate, you won't find my website.
I just did that, and I thought, oh, he must not have stood one up yet. What is up with Google? There's only one. If you Google Sean Parnell for Senate, it ought to go to your website.
It's really look, when we talk about reforming Section 230 and trying to figure out what we do with big tech, it's a problem. This is a textbook example of big tech putting their thumb on the scale. The only way that I raise digital money, and Hugh, you know this, is through my website. It's the future. It's the way that we the best way for candidates to raise money. And as you know, campaigns are all about your ability to raise money. Well, Google's making it harder for me to do that. If you punch in.
It's incredible. I put in Sean Parnell for Senate, and then I went double down campaign website. I got Republican Sean Parnell announces run for the Senate from NBC News. I got your Twitter handle at Sean Parnell USA, which is good, but it's not the same. I got a Facebook link. I got a Ballotpedia listing. I got an AP news story. I got a Pittsburgh City paper story, which is, I'm sure, going to be complimentary. I didn't get your website. It's absolutely astonishing to me. It's what I'm looking for.
If you go to Yahoo or Bing or DuckDuckGo and punch in the same thing, my website comes up first, right? So here, what the problem is that the vast majority of this country uses Google, and if you just punch in any of my opponents, like just throw in any one of the Democrat candidates, throw in John Fetterman, and his website comes up first. So here's Google making it easier for a Democrat opponent to raise money and more difficult for me, the Republican.
So repeat, if you can, the campaign website for people.
Yeah, it's parnellforsenate.com. You can learn all about my platform there. I'm an open book. And perhaps most importantly, if you feel compelled, contribute to the campaign and help me win this fight.
Now, that's Parnell with two L's for the Steelers fans. There's only one L in Steelers, so they're gonna forget that second L. You are a Steelers fan, aren't you, Sean?
Of course. In fact, when we kicked off the campaign, Hugh, we went into South Philly to the Italian market there, and I told all the business owners there, look, I'm not going to be one of those pandering politicians that should I be honored to throw out a first pitch at a Phillies game. I ain't wearing a half Philadelphia hat, half Pittsburgh Pirates hat. I'm just a straight Pittsburgh fan through and through. And I think I think they respected that. I think the Philly fans respected the loyalty and dedication to all things Pittsburgh.
How'd you like that playoff game this year? Browns, Pittsburgh, and Three Rivers. How'd you like that? I liked that a lot. That was really special to me. I thought that was the best playoff game I may have seen in 20 years. In fact, it was the only playoff win I've seen in 20 years. So even the Browns fans.
I'm not going to talk about the past. I'm not going to talk about the past. OK, the Steelers have this. I'm focused on the future. I'll give a very political answer. I'm focused on the future. I think the Steelers are uniquely positioned this year to have.
Oh,
one
they sure are. Oh, they're very uniquely positioned. Called the last season for Tara for Big Ben. I want to give absolution for any Browns fan who wants to support Sean Parnell for Senate. And it's parnellforsenate.com. Sean, let me go back to the campaign specific. There are a bunch of Democrats who are thinking about running. They're going to be lifted by the coattails of Josh Shapiro. I know the attorney general. I think he's a very fine candidate. I don't even know if we've got anyone in the race. So you're going to be battling a headwind. On the other hand, you'll be running against Joe Biden. And Joe Biden has not been good for Pennsylvania, as far as I understand. He's been very bad for Pennsylvania. So does that offset the Shapiro edge? He's a very big statewide vote getter. How do you keep yourself out of the governor's race focused on the Senate?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think the state of Pennsylvania is imminently winnable for Republicans. I think that in 2022, we're going to have the wind at our back. And Josh Shapiro, he's got statewide name recognition, but in a divided state like Pennsylvania, that can be a double-edged sword. You know, he of course, will be a strong incumbent on the Democrat side. But look, Hugh, in 2020, even with all of the chaos with the pandemic and the election here in Pennsylvania and the last minute changes, unilateral changes to election law here, we still had two Republicans win statewide in the state of Pennsylvania. And congressional Republicans got 80,000 more votes statewide than congressional Democrats. This state is winnable. And then you add to that all the disastrous policy decisions by the Biden administration, whether it's people's taxes rising, debt and deficit soaring, a border being flooded, energy industry being crushed, the First Amendment under attack, Second Amendment is too. There are lots of things that we're going to have to campaign on. And I think at the end of the day in 2022, you're going to have a lot of, you know, moderate Democrats and independents that maybe have a little bit of buyer's remorse with Joe Biden, who most of these folks thought that he was going to be a moderate, but he's been anything but in the first 100 plus days of his presidency. And I think they're going to come back our way. And so part of what I'm excited about, Hugh, being at the top of the ticket, is setting a vision for Pennsylvania, one of economic prosperity, unshackling the Pennsylvania economy, protecting the energy industry, but also, right, having a strong, innovative, market-based GOP plan for healthcare, right? We want to make sure that people have a litany of choices for healthcare, and we want to make sure that we do everything we can to drive the costs down with good market-based solutions. And so all that, I think, is going to be important because at the end of the day here, I think what people in Pennsylvania want, Democrat, Republican, Independent, is just to pass a stronger, more vibrant country down to the next generation. And I think if we can articulate a strong vision for what that looks like, Republicans are going to be successful in 2022.
We got a minute left, Sean. I'm from Warren, Ohio. So northeastern Ohio is basically Pennsylvania. I grew up 7 miles from Sharon. So I know your homeland very, very well. How do you play over on the other part of the state that I don't know? From Harrisburg east, how does Sean Parnell's brand work there?
Well, I think it's going to work fine because my brand is not necessarily about a Republican solution or a Democrat solution, right? My brand is about finding the right solution for the people of Pennsylvania. And so we're going to take that message and the idea that the Republican Party is the party of ideological diversity. I don't care if you're a Democrat, independent, maybe we think a little bit differently, but if you believe that American greatness is worth fighting for and you believe that America is a fundamentally good place, you're welcome in our platoon, you know, in our tent. And so we're going to take that message everywhere, and I think it's going to resonate.
You know, I think you'll get past that 45,000 mark quickly. ParnellForSenate.com. On Twitter, it's Sean Parnell USA. Am I right about that?
That's right. Thanks, Hugh.
Hey, Sean, good to talk to you. We'll talk to you often. Like I said, when Schlichter's in for me, you basically will be co-hosting. So enjoy that, even though you have to be with Kurt. Thank you, Sean Parnell. Be well.
Thanks.
ParnellForSenate.com. That Google thing was just wild. I'm glad I'm not losing my mind. I was thinking, really, Parnell for Senate? I ought to be able to find Parnell for Senate. And sure enough, there it is. It's full-blown. It's fully loading. Text Sean to 47682, Sean Parnell for Senate. You get the email, the cell phone, the zip. They'll get you involved in the campaign. But I just cannot believe that Google makes it that hard to find Sean Parnell. That is a thumb on the scale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Joined by former United States Senator Jim Talent, who represented the great state of Missouri. He is now with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Follow him at Jim Talent on Twitter. Good morning, Senator Talent. How are you?
Good morning. Great work you've been doing with Ambassador Orrin and pointing out his essay in the Tablet. It's essential reading.
I think people who have listened to the 6 or 7 times the ambassador has been on since Hamas attacked Israel have noted that in his voice there is a growing sort of grim determination that Israel will not leave until all of the launchers it can destroy are destroyed and all the rockets that it can destroy are destroyed. Do you hear that too, Senator Talent?
Well, yeah, I do. And I think it's really important not only to teach the right lesson to Hamas, but also to help avoid the possibility of, in essence, a two-front conflict for Israel if Hezbollah were to become active. So you want to take care of the one aggressor rather than wait until they both attack.
Yeah, I believe one of the benefits of the Abraham Accords was that Sudan, from which many of the missiles that are now being fired at Israel transited from Iran, is now part of the solution, not part of the problem. So as Hamas expends their inventory, they're not going to be able to resupply it as easily.
That's true. And one of the things that Ambassador Oren points out in the tablet is how quickly the Biden administration is moving to take steps which could really undermine those accords, both by the relief it's providing Iran, but also by the U-turn in policy and the opposition to the Saudis, and basically sanctioning or punishing them for their role behind the scenes in, you know, in trying to construct the Abraham Accords. I'm very concerned about that.
Earlier this morning, Israel National News reported, quote, Iranian President Rouhani saying, "We have reached agreements with the superpowers on the main part of the agreement. The West has agreed to remove key sanctions on oil, petrochemical, shipping, insurance, and central banks." Back to appeasement, Jim Talent.
Right. And look, this is it's all because of a strategy that Obama had and Biden is picking up again to try and construct a security arrangement in the Middle East around a partnership with Iran. And it won't work because Iran is hegemonic. It is totalitarian and it wants to dominate the region and the other countries in the region, including our traditional allies and partners, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, the Gulf states, and in the last few years, the Saudis are not going to go along with it. So what we're going to do is we're going to end up without any influence with anybody because Iran is still going to hate us. And the countries that do have a mutual interest with us are going to suspect us and distrust us because we're turning our back on them. It imperils the Abraham Accords. Those accords were founded on the foundation of a common interest of those countries in the United States in containing Iranian ambitions and aggression. And if you're going to reach out to Iran, you undermine the whole basis for those accords.
You know, it's also, besides totalitarian, it's Khomeiniist. And unlike Marxist-Leninists that want all of capitalism to go down, Khomeiniism is martyrdom-oriented and really wants to destroy Israel and the United States. You know, Senator Talent, when I look at what's going on, especially in the media from the very virulent statements about Israel, it's no longer about sort of a vision of being Nixon to China and getting Iran aligned. They really, a large part of the Democratic Party is anti-Israel. I don't even know if they support the right of the state to exist anymore.
Yeah, you've been reading, probably have, Barry Weiss's column about it or her columns about it. It's very discouraging. There are still strong voices. She interviewed Congressman Torres, who is a good voice, but they're increasingly in the minority. And pressuring Biden to abandon Israel, which, you know, he's not really for in the first place. Yeah, it's very difficult. Look, it is a recipe for war and instability in the Middle East. You're right, obviously, about Iran. They're the state sponsor of jihad in the world. And it's just amazing to me to watch the progress that President Trump achieved there, which is really just a continuation of our basic strategy in the past of partnering with Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf states to stabilize the region around an acceptable equilibrium. And Biden is abandoning them. And there are other voices in the party that are worse.
You know, young millennial journalists and young members of Congress, they do not seem to know the story of Israel. They really don't. And I think they hate Netanyahu so much. They think Netanyahu is a Republican or something. They do not understand Israeli politics. And they are, I give you the last 45 seconds, Senator, they're just not very smart about the Middle East.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I liked your interviews with Fred Barnes and Matt Continetti, who were talking about why. I think part of it is an ignorance, just a lack of knowledge, a lack of the historical background. I mean, Ben Rhodes called it on him a few years ago when he said, look, I don't really know anything. So if whatever we tell them, they believe. I do think that's a part of the problem, particularly with the newer generation.
100%. And if they would simply read Lionsgate by Stephen Pressfield, I think maybe the best one volume. It's not purely history. It's sort of juiced up history so that it makes it more dramatic and brings you into the moment. They would be well served. Jim Talent is available at Twitter at Jim Talent. I'm available in hour three. Peter Baker of The New York Times joins me. James Homan of The Washington Post. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. We talked to Dr. Peter Baker, degree recipient from Oberlin College, I believe, this past week. Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Nothing misses, you don't miss anything, do you?
No, I pay. Well, Oberlin is where my father and brother went, class of 46 and 73, respectively. So I'm always watching Oberlin news. Congratulations. Is their nickname still the Yeoman, or have they been forced to abandon that?
No, it is. Yeoman, Yeowomen. If you're a swimmer, they call them the Yeo Fish. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Very good. I am curious. How often do you do commencement addresses?
Not that often, no. This is probably my second or third, something like that.
All right. That's where I am, and my belief is short is best because nobody's really listening to you anyway. How long did you go?
Probably about 15 minutes. I mean, look, you're at that point, you have to know you're just a speed bump between the graduates and whatever party they want to have, you know?
100%. 100%. Well, good for you. You had self-awareness. Peter, yesterday I had your new colleague, I say new, relatively speaking, Jane Costin on my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Do you know Jane?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
When you meet her, you'll be very impressed. She's remarkably smart and responsive to questions. I would encourage you to give it a listen. In our conversation, I asked her for her best guesses, intuitions about various questions about elite media, and I defined it for her. And I asked her what percentage of that defined group, it's about 5,000 people, voted for Donald Trump, and she said about 2%, and I agree with that. And then I asked her what percentage are solidly pro-Israel. I mean, Hugh Hewitt pro-Israel. She said maybe 12%. 12%. Do you agree with her assessments in both cases?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't have any data to work with. I'm going to duck the question a little bit just because I don't know. But you're probably right that it would not be a large number, certainly on the first question. On the second one, I don't know. It's a little harder to say. But, look, I don't vote. I'll tell you that just to start with. I haven't voted since the 90s when I started at the White House. I just decided it was easier not to ever make up my mind, even the privacy of the voting booth, if I was going to cover the person who was going to end up winning one way or the other. Now, I get a lot of grief from people about that, but I don't tell anybody else that's what they should do. But that's been my formula for a long time, because it's important to keep as open a mind as possible, even though, of course, all human beings are biased. All human beings have, the experiences that shape their outlooks. But for journalists, in my view, it's important to be as open-minded and neutral as possible going in with a fresh look at things.
That's a conversation for another day. Jane noted, and I agree, that many journalists follow what I call the Len Downey model and do not vote in elections. I think that's more form over substance because they have a point of view, and I think it's better to be transparent about your point of view. But that's another conversation. I just think you'll find it interesting if you listen to her. I agree with all of her assessments. Basically, maybe one or two out of 25 opinions I agree with, and that puts the media solidly left, and in the Democratic Party extension office. But let me ask you about Israel, because you and your wife, Susan, we're in Israel for a lot of years. How many years did you work for the Times? And I guess she might have been with the New Yorker there, and I don't know who Susan was with.
Yeah, we weren't there very long. We were going to be there for 3 years. We ended up being there about 5 months because the idea was, basically after the 2016 election, the bosses called and said, come on home. We need more bodies. This White House thing is going to be a bigger story. So we didn't spend as much time there as I would have liked. We were really looking forward to our tour. So I spent 5 months there, which is basically the blink of an eye.
Boy, I would give my eye teeth to spend 5 months in Israel, even though it is 5 months.
Yeah.
But you missed, there wasn't a war then, correct?
Not a war then, no. But, this is one thing I would say I learned from the very short time there was this has always been a tinderbox. And I think that, we had grown complacent with the idea that this had settled into kind of an uneasy but calm status quo. And it really hadn't, the fundamental underlying conflict is still there day in, day out. It just was waiting for something to set it off. And here we are once again.
Now, I've had Ambassador Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States and former deputy minister, on for about six out of the last 10 shows when he calls in from Israel. And my audience has heard, and I have heard, a distinct hardening of his voice, a line. Originally thought this is on the clock. It won't go very long. Now he's in, we need to do what we need to do to erase these missiles and these launchers. Have you noticed that, Peter?
Well, I think it's probably gone a little longer than people had thought. Yeah, I think people, because there have been flare-ups in the past where both sides pulled back pretty quickly because they wanted to avoid a sort of all-out confrontation. Now we seem to have been to at least a pretty medium-sized escalation where they have not they've gone beyond just the quick strike to make a point. They're trying to make some progress in getting rid of these tunnels and getting rid of some of the Hamas commanders that they have targeted for years. So no question that it's become a more prolonged conflict than people have thought at the beginning.
I also think that they have developed new precision weaponry that has earth-penetrating capability that allows them to actually destroy the launchers and the supply. And with the Abraham Accords with Sudan, the resupply of those missiles, which came from Iran through Sudan, typically over the Red Sea to Gaza, is not going to be easy to do. They're effectively eradicating most of the threat on their southern border.
Well, I think that's certainly what their goal is. I don't have access to intelligence to know exactly what kind of impact it's had, but I think that's certainly the goal. Because, look, you can understand obviously that this is a constant day in day out threat. Like everybody who covers the area, I've visited Gaza. I have visited the towns around Gaza that feel threatened. It's a very, very volatile place.
Tommy Veeder, one of the privileged pod boys from the Obama years, originally acknowledged that AP knew Hamas was in its building. Do you know if AP knew, Peter?
No, I don't. But I know the people who work for AP there, and I trust them implicitly. I think they're top-notch journalists, and whatever they would tell me, I would put a lot of faith in.
Would you occupy a building that had Hamas offices in it? Not for fear of personal safety, but just as a moral issue.
Well, I mean, look, Gaza is a place where, Hamas is in control of the whole place. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know what your options are at that point. And you don't have a lot of freedom to move around in Gaza. And it's not a place where you have a lot of flexibility as a journalist. I only visited one time, but it was very clear to me that your ability to report in Gaza is a real challenge. They do not make it easy. The time I was there, they had banned the New York Times from reporting out of Gaza because they didn't like our coverage. And so I was there to go in to talk to the Hamas leadership to try to get our ability to report from there, back on track. I wasn't successful. And I think that, it's a really hard place. And I would be very, very supportive of journalists who are doing a hard job there.
Well, I would ask their bosses, another long conversation. I don't think American journalists should be in a terrorist state. And when, in fact, the pressure from the organization, and they'll kill people, they'll just kill people, and they put them as shields. I don't think we ought to operate there. And if you have to sort of filter the news, you have to filter the news. But the pressure on them, there's a little Stockholm syndrome that's going to go on anywhere, Peter Baker.
Well, I think we should be everywhere. I think that's our job as reporters. We were in Afghanistan. I reported from inside of Saddam Hussein's Iraq. I think that it's important for reporters. I went to Chechnya. I think it's important for reporters to be everywhere they possibly can, especially places where, the news is always going to be different looking on the ground than it is when people in authority tell you what's happening. And I think that's important.
All right, we'll disagree. Let me go back to the White House. This White House has stood by Israel fairly firmly. There are lots of leaks that maybe they're not. But the Democratic Party on the Hill is far to the left of the Biden White House. Will the Biden White House shift, in your opinion? Do you hear murmurs that they're going to increase the pressure on Netanyahu to stop degrading the Hamas terrorist organization?
Well, I think you're already seeing that a little bit. I mean, as you say, in hearing Michael Oren's voice hardened. I think you're hearing Biden's voice harden somewhat in the last few days. Yesterday, he used the word today. He expected there to be a de-escalation today. That's, setting a time element we hadn't done before. I think he he's continuously used that phrase, Israel has the right to defend itself. But at the same time, he is using what now people are referring to as the C word, ceasefire, more frequently. Biden is juggling a tough domestic political situation, no question about it. The poll that Morning Consult and Politico put out yesterday was really fascinating, showed that basically pretty solid on the Republican side support for Israel, not much sympathy for the Palestinians there. Among Democrats, much more divided. The biggest, largest group of people who identify as Democrats said they were sympathetic to both sides. Then that was about 36%, I think, something like that. 18% said they were more sympathetic to Palestinians, 12% said they're more sympathetic to Israelis. So within the Democratic Party, he's got a more complicated set of politics to juggle.
And within the media. I really do believe Jane Costin is right about that. People want to hear what she had to say. Head over to the interview with Hugh Hewitt on iTunes or Spotify. Peter Baker of the New York Times, always a pleasure to talk with you, Peter. Congratulations on the Oberlin honorary degree. I congratulate you and the yeomen and yo people. Stay tuned, America. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.
Uptown got its hustlers.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. We played the wrong bump. That's Garrity, the Indispensables bump. James Homan doesn't have a bump yet because Stanford doesn't have sports the way they used to. James Homan is a Washington Post columnist. Good morning, James. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hugh, and we're bringing back the sports, the university back down.
Oh, they yielded? Good. Public opinion matters.
They're bringing back all 11. It's great news.
That's a great column for you. Now, I want to say, Your column this morning in the Washington Post, don't pay people to get the COVID vaccine, shame them. I believe the headline writers did you wrong, James. I don't think this is what your column says.
It's not. It's not at all. It's not about shaming. I just have been so, I mean, I've frankly found the giveaways obscene, the kind of the government handouts, the idea of giving away millions of dollars in free cars and lotteries. And I get that we're trying to get people to take the vaccine. It just feels like it's not the proper role of government. The private businesses can do all the giveaways they want of free fries and beers and whatever. But I've been increasingly uncomfortable with the idea that we're habituating people to depend on handouts to take a vaccine to protect themselves. It's just not what government should be doing.
See, I would say your column is that government incentives are a moral hazard. Because people will come to expect an incentive to do what is in their best interest, and therefore you create what is known by economists as moral hazard. But there is no gainsaying they are effective. When Larry Hogan said, I'll give every state employee $100 to get vaccinated, he did something that was effective. And my economist of choice, Dr. McKenzie, says that which gets rewarded gets repeated. So there's no doubt in your column that incentives work. You're just worried about the moral hazard of them.
Exactly. And I really do. I think that it will be marginally effective. I talked to Mike DeWine folks. They say, look, we're giving away $5 million, but we got more than $5 million in free media, free advertising by announcing this. So we would have spent that money on public service announcements that would have been kind of boring. Why not do it this way? I think it just sends the wrong message. And the column sort of leads with, we didn't have to bribe people. Government didn't have to bribe people to get the polio vaccine. I think it says something about us kind of going soft as a country, to be sure. You know, 60% of people have lined up eagerly to get the vaccine, but it shouldn't be government trying to like coax and prod the people to do what's in their own best interest.
Now, James Homan, you're a columnist now, and everybody knows we don't work very hard. And so I have this book in front of me called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe by Neil Ferguson. Now, admittedly, he's a Stanford guy now, so you may be hesitant. Have you read Doom yet?
I got a copy. I have not read it yet. I'm eager to.
Well, the Jonas Salk example that you cite is really inopposite to what we are doing here. And, in fact, Neil makes the argument it was the wrong campaign at the wrong time because we ought to have been concerned with the 57-58 flu and not the polio vaccine because of the self-interest being so large. But I recommend it to you. It's really quite a comprehensive review of what works and what doesn't work in vaccination. I do want to take issue, otherwise it wouldn't be any fun, with one part of your column. You seem to deprecate all concerns about the vaccine. Now, I've had Dr. Collins, who I think is the very best government spokesperson on this, bar none. I think he's the very best, especially for evangelicals, of whom he is one. and other people of faith with whom he shares certain ideas about the universe, he recognizes pregnant women may have legitimate concerns. They may choose to put it off. He recognizes that many people have legitimate questions that they have to talk to with their doctor. I didn't see you calling people to shame the vaccine hesitant, but I do think you are perhaps indifferent to some of the legitimate concerns.
No, we only get 750 words to write a column. So I didn't have the to be sure paragraph that maybe I should have, but I agree with you. I mean, I know a lot of very, very smart pregnant women who have chosen not to get the vaccine while they're pregnant. And obviously that's not just their choice, but prudent, perhaps. And I think that there are definitely people who have had bad reactions to other vaccines. I think a lot of people are concerned about the side effects from the second dose and want to, you know, I don't think it's a bunch of anti-vaxxers. I don't think the entire population that hasn't gotten the vaccine yet is anti-vaxxers. There are a lot of persuadables who just want to understand the risks and the rewards. And I think it's important to reason with those people, to inform those people, to have people like Francis Collins who are credible messengers. But the upshot of the column is I don't think the government's job is to basically pay people to do something, because ultimately that does not do anything to deal with those very legitimate concerns or misinformation that's out there by just paying people $100 savings bond to go get the vaccine if they don't think it's going to be safe.
Well, now, this is interesting. Again, I have to disagree with you. Neil Ferguson argues that we are in the middle of an infodemic as well as pandemic, meaning that there is terrible amounts of information about the virus. There's good information about things like ivermectin, which may be effective, and Dr. Collins said so. They're running a real trial on it, maybe not. But there's some terrible information out there, one of which I hear all the time, which is the FDA hasn't really approved it, which he answered and Ashton answered. But if individuals are out there getting flooded with bad information, because that's what the web does, then if the government breaks through the message cloud with an incentive that makes people think twice, I think that is kind of an effective use of government funding. I hate the lottery, by the way, and I like Mike DeWine. I think that's dumb. I would have given people...
Well, my pushback on that would be that there is a lot. There's a whole, you know, it's funny because the people who are supporting campaigns like the lottery say, well, you know, we've done research that when you give people cash, they're more likely to do something, and duh. But there's also human subjects research that shows when you offer someone a cash payment to do something, people become, I've talked anecdotally to psychologists who say if someone's doing like an experiment in a lab where they're getting paid to do something, they read the waiver that they're signing much more closely because they feel like they're taking on some risk. If you're giving someone something of value to do something, it psychologically could make people feel like it's maybe riskier than it really is.
You're actually discovering Adam Smith here, because anecdotal evidence is evidence of anecdotes. Look, incentives matter. I agree with Richard McKenzie. If you incentivize people to do something, they will do more of it. It's just human nature. We're selfish human beings, and with the selfish gene, Richard Dawkins. But every case is different, and if it works, given the risk, and this is what I really want to get to, you touch on it. The risk is really a variant that evades the vaccine developing in a place like Brazil or India where it is rampant and coming back. We have to snuff it out, not just in the United States, but everywhere as quickly as possible to reduce the risk of a variant evading vaccine. And that is, to me, the key message, Jim, is that it's not about, James, it's not just about us. It's about children, grandchildren, and generations yet unborn.
Yes. It really is. And that's where, I mean, I'll check out the Neil Ferguson book, but I do feel like as a country, and this isn't, you know, this isn't some liberal idea or whatever, but you do have to have this kind of sense of obligation to the country. And I do think getting the vaccine, if you can, you know, not satisfy your individual concerns, is a patriotic thing to do for just the reasons you outlined.
I agree. It is a patriotic thing to do. I also have made the argument, which doesn't sit well with some of my friends, that it's the Christian thing to do because you're doing no harm. And it's also the smart thing to do because the overwhelming amount of evidence, and it is overwhelming, is that it will not hurt you and all but the tiniest. I mean, you take more risk driving on the 405 every day or getting on the beltway is like 25 times the risk of the vaccine. And the day after the second shot, yeah, it's like a one-day flu. Everybody's going to have far worse days than that every year. So we've made that point. Now I want to ask you about Jane Costin. Do you know her?
I don't
know
her.
Have you listened to any of her work?
I have, yeah.
I want you to listen to my podcast with her and then come back and take the Jane question test with me.
Okay, deal.
The Jane questions are great, and when you read it, you'll see why. You'll probably change your mind. You won't do it, James. You won't do it in the end. But because you're a Post reporter, you won't do it. But she is fearless and was willing to take the Jane question test. So when you listen to it, I think you will. Let me close by asking you about Stanford's decision. I really am interested in this. When did they make that decision? Were they just raising money, as you suspected 2 weeks ago? What's going on there?
So I think that they actually were concerned about litigation. I think that this was a situation where a bunch of athletes had threatened or were suing the university because they were saying that, you know, they had come to Stanford on the understanding that they were going to be able to wrestle for 4 years and that the university was concerned about getting bogged down in protracted litigation. People were withholding donations. There was a lot of former student athletes, even, you know, big names like Andrew Locke, signed on to a letter calling for the university to back down. And, you know, one of the coolest things about going to Stanford was like more than 10% of the undergraduate student body are Division I athletes. And those people are more disciplined. They're more focused. They're very smart, in my experience. And so it's just such a huge part of the campus culture. These aren't just like, you know, jocks taking rocks classes. These are really, really bright, hardworking, disciplined people. And, you know, Katie Ledecky, people like that. So I think that the university recognized under this mounting pressure, losing donations and facing what could have been multiple years of litigation.
You know, rocks for jocks, that's an unfair smear. That's a very useful course that is offered on many campuses. And I know many people who took rocks for jocks over the years. But I go back, I'm not buying the litigation because I'm a lawyer. And the deal is, okay, we'll fulfill our commitments to you, but that litigation will be over in 3 years. That's not it. It's a money deal. And Stanford, the interesting thing this exposes, I think, James, Stanford allegedly is run by the smartest people in America, right? They got the administrators the equal of any university in the world, and they make a bonehead move. I mean, just an absolute predictable new Coke moment. To what do you put that degree of ignorance?
That a lot of them, they are really smart, but the problem in a university, and I think maybe it's less the case in other schools, but you know, none of the people who are on the kind of the managerial side of the university have any experience or background in athletics. They're not big football fans. Like Condi Rice, when she was provost, was an obsessive football fan.
She was an obsessive Browns fan, James Holman. Let's be accurate.
That's true. Condi never would have made this boneheaded decision because she understood the value of sports to the campus community. I think a lot of these people are, you know, academics who just don't really get it.
You know, academics are a lot like journalists inside the Beltway. They often don't know anything about the world which they are regulating. But James, your column was not, you know, whenever I get a headline like that, I ask the guys and gals to change it, and they do. Are you going to ask them to change that headline? Because it's not really
the... I think I will.
It's not doing you. I mean, the moral hazard of vaccine bribery is a great headline. I don't know. Maybe I'll take a second job at the Post. James Holman, follow him on Twitter at James Holman. Go read his column. I tweeted out. Come back for the last segment. Your calls are welcome. 1-800-520-1234. Especially if you read or listened to Jane Costin. 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I do not want you to forget relieffactor.com. All those athletes at Stanford whose sports have been returned, you need Relief Factor. Settle. Say, hey, you disrupted my life. You gave me anguish. So you at least ought to put bowls of relieffactor.com in all of the incredible first-rate, spoiled athlete environs of Stanford. You know, the risk of walking on a Stanford campus, of getting hit by a bicycle, is actually far greater than the risk from the vaccine of any sort. I mean, bicycles on Stanford, it makes the 405 look tame. I would encourage all of you who are on bikes or get hit by bikes to get relieffactor.com. Support for the temporary relief of minor aches and pains. 1995. Get you started. Join the tens of thousands of people who take it every day. My number is 1-800-520-1234. The lines are open for any reason, America.